This is the Next Bite of Life podcast, the place to be to hear personal stories from expats, digital nomads, and everybody else taking their next bite of life. Hey, thanks for joining me on this episode of Next Bite of Life. My guest today is Jeanette Edmid. She is currently in the Canary Islands in Spain. So we're going to learn how she got there and why she's known as the Colombian Catwoman. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi there, Kim. Good morning. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Thanks for joining me. I know it's kind of early for you, but you know,
yeah,
I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So now, Jeanette, how long have you been in the Canary Islands?
So I've been here for just slightly over a year. I arrived last year, April, so just slightly over a year.
What brought you there?
Initially, it was for a job. I was recruited. I was living in the UK at the time, but I was looking for another position. I'm a teacher by profession, so I was looking for another position that would pay for my flight, pay for things, and help me to get to where I needed to get to. So a position came up here. I applied for it. I was successful. The company that I was employed by paid for my flights over, paid for the flights for my four cats. Helped me to get my accommodation sorted out. So there was a lot of support in that process, which was really useful because it became really difficult traveling with four cats and finding a place to live with four cats.
I can just imagine.
Like one cat, maybe four cats, nobody wanted to rent even a shed to me, you know.
Oh my god.
So yeah, that's how I ended up here in Gran Canaria. And just to let you know and your listeners know, I actually worked on this island 20 years ago in 1999-2000 as a holiday rep. I worked on the Canary Islands, so Fuerteventura, Tenerife and Gran Canaria. And then with the same company, I went to Jamaica and worked for them for just under a season as well. So, yeah, I'm right back to where I was 20 years ago in a different situation as the Colombian cat. Yeah.
You worked for that company. Now, when you moved, you know, to the Caribbean, did they pay for that flight as well and everything?
Yeah, so I can't remember the company's name now because a lot of the travel companies in the UK, they went bust. And then they all merged and things like that. So it was part of one of the big players. That's what I can tell you at the time. And so I originally started off in Fuerteventura. And I really wanted to work in Jamaica. And my mum's Jamaican. I mean, she's passed away now, but she's Jamaican. And so I pressured my mum to go to the embassy, in the Jamaican embassy in London, in the capital, and to get a Jamaican passport, which I did, and we did, because that's who I am. And I got a Jamaican passport, and so eventually they sent me to Jamaica. So I lived in a hotel on the site. The food was very basic, but I had all my meals provided for me. And it was quite a lonely experience, to be fair. Living and working on the Canary Islands as a holiday rep was a very different experience. I lived in a shared house with other holiday reps. We had our days off together. We'd go out and explore. We'd do things. It was very much a team effort. We had, you know, big meetings. The team was really, really big. We'd do a lot of things together, and Jamaica was the very opposite of that. I lived in a hotel room on my own. My peers were local staff, so they had their families. They lived elsewhere. I don't know if we had the same days off. I can't remember that now, but I do know that I was the outsider and I wasn't received particularly well. And it was a very lonely experience is what I would say. I'm glad I had it. But, you know, it wasn't, you know, like, for example, when I worked here on the Canary Islands, we used to do cabaret every week. Mm-hmm. And I used to sing as part of the cabaret. And I also used to perform in a sketch. And the sketch was kind of me rolling around on the floor, pretending to be pregnant. But, you know, those kind of things are all bonding moments that, you know, you're selling tickets for the cabaret, the weekly cabaret. You go into the cabaret with your guests. It's a huge thing to do. And then Jamaica was very much the opposite of that. I lived in a hotel room on my own.
Now, That's incredible because, you know, you said your mom was from Jamaica. Mm-hmm. So it didn't make it easier, did it? Like, did you have family left there? Like, did you know anybody else apart from work?
So my mother was from the capital, Kingston, and I was living up in Westmoreland. I don't know if you know anything of Jamaica. So I was living up on the northeast coast. No, not northeast, northwest coast, Westmoreland. It's like the furthest tip away from the southeast, which is where Kingston is. There isn't, my mother came from a very small family. It was just her and her half-brother. Her half-brother's still around, her mother. So it wasn't as though kind of, you know, people were around waiting to receive me with open arms, the prodigal granddaughter or anything like that. So I didn't have any contact. And I don't even know if my grandmother was still alive by then. I don't think she was alive. I met my grandmother once. We went to Jamaica when maybe I was about 16, 18. I must have been about 18, 19 actually, and I met my grandmother then as an adult, and that was the only relationship that I actually had with her. So there wasn't anyone to go and look for at that time. But what I can say is, since my mum passed away a few years ago, I went to Jamaica on a little bit of a pilgrimage to kind of find out a bit more about her. My mother was very kind of closed. So I went to Kingston and I met her half-brother for the first time. I met his daughter, my cousin, for the first time. I went to, I think, the place where she used to kind of play on the weekends as a child. So I learned a little bit more about the, you know, my mother's background. So that was good to do. That was good to do.
Nice. Now, when you came back, like, you basically grew up in the UK, right?
Yeah, I was born. Bred in Birmingham City, so I'm a Brummie, is what we say.
So that's all you've ever known. So it was quite the experience. Now, where did you get this bug to travel? Was it from your mom or from your dad, or a combination of both? Because if they went all the way from Jamaica to the UK, then, you know, they already had traveling in their blood.
Yeah, when you're traveling as, you know, a migrant, it's not the same experience. It's not kind of for fun in the case of my parents. So they were more than likely economic migrants. My mother left Jamaica when she was 14 years old.
Ah, okay.
She went to stay with her mother, who was already living in the UK. But then a few years later, the smog, which we used to have huge problems with the smog in the UK, was so bad that my grandmother couldn't take it anymore and went back to Jamaica. And my mother was still in the UK. And by the time she was 18, she met my father and started and became pregnant. And you know, that was then her journey. But that was their travel journey, so to speak. But I would say, I definitely get the nomadic spirit from my father, who was a bit of a papa, was a rolling stone. Let's just say.
So you got that love for travel from your dad. Is that, did that influence what you wanted to do? That did you go into teaching because you wanted to travel, or just because you love the actual profession?
I don't love the profession.
You know, it's funny, I had a friend in California and he was trying to become an actor, and every time I'm like, are you loving it anymore? He's like, no, this is just like until I get my next big break or something, you know. And it's just, it's funny to hear teachers say that, because it's a very hard job. It's not, it doesn't give you the money for sure that it should, and the respect that it should, because really you're responsible for shaping the future of the world.
That's a whole nother story. Let me just say to you, I'm not one of those teachers who, you know, during quarantine, you've seen some teachers, for example, in Latin America, riding their bikes to go to local villages to help their students, or standing in front of their homes or waiting to give them a hug because they miss them that much. I'm not one of those teachers.
You just do your job and move on, right?
Yeah, I mean, what I will say to you is, so a couple of things there. I went into teaching late. I did everything late in life. I got my first degree in 2006. So I think that's what, 15 years ago, 14 years ago. So I was about 30. I'm just trying to do the math, and I'm not great at math sometimes, especially this early in the morning. So
I was 30. What? I hope you're not teaching math.
No, I've been asked, and I'm like, hell to the no. Math and science, don't ask me anything about that, my two worst subjects. So okay. I got my first degree when I was 30. So it wasn't as though I had this burning desire from a young age to be a teacher. I didn't have the qualifications when I was old. When I was younger, I didn't leave school with great grades. So it was a journey. But what I will say to you is I went into teaching as a profession because two of my brothers were excluded from the system and I wanted to make a change.
Okay.
That was where that desire came from. Wanting to be, because if we want to see change, we have to be part of it. And being part of it, we have to be in positions of authority to make that change or make those changes. But what I will say to you is I've had a horrendous experience in the teaching profession, and I've been bullied, and I've had horrendous experiences with some of the parents and expectations from some parents and delusion from some parents. And management styles that Hitler would have been proud of, and lots of other things have happened. So I don't want to work in that profession anymore. However, it may well be the case that I need to go back. Never say never, but I don't want to. But never say never, because life is what it is, and out of necessity, one might do what they don't want to do. I'm not going to go and rob and steal. So, I might go back into the classroom again, but it's been horrendous because I've also had to deal with my mental health. And so my mental health hasn't helped the environment, which is standing in a classroom with 30 other people and my head kind of ticking all of the time and overworking. So I can't tell you it's been a joyous journey or a joyous experience. I'm glad I've done it. I'm glad I had the opportunity to go and teach in Dubai. I'm working in international school, and that was the best experience, and let me tell you for why. It wasn't the experience that I anticipated and expected to have in terms of being received by my peers, my European peers predominantly, is what I thought was going to happen. But I was in a department with incredible people, and they were fantastic, and they became my friends and my family. And so we used to laugh so much, and we'd be in the staff room laughing down the place. The bell would go, we're supposed to be in our classrooms preparing for our students, we're still there laughing and running jokes. Shit, my students are waiting for me, run! And sometimes the headmaster would have to come into the staff room to tell us to tone it down because we were laughing so much and busting jokes.
Wow. Now that's really enjoying your job.
How long
were you in Dubai? How long were you in Dubai?
2 years.
Oh, 2 years. Wow. Yeah. That must have been fun. What made you leave then if it was such a great time?
No, so my colleagues, my friends, they were incredible. But what I will say to you is that's where my real bout of mental health started in Dubai. And also it wasn't in keeping as the type of country that it is. Not a country, it's a city, Dubai, it's part of a country. So it's all about bullshit and brunches and shiny objects and deserts. And I need nature. I need to be around nature. I'm an earth sign, and I need the ground to ground me and to feel that there are trees and parks and flowers and things like that around me. And Dubai is the very total opposite of that. It's all shiny, it's all new, which is great, which is important, but the parks are few and far between. Grass is few and far between. Mountains are few and far between. You could go to Oman, which I did. I went on a little road trip to Oman, but Dubai isn't green. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I know. So did you liked Oman better?
Oman.
Why didn't you transfer to a school there?
Well, a couple of things. One is salaries aren't as good in Oman, I think, because life is just better, so they don't have to offer the packages that they have to offer in Dubai. And I had a real burning desire to go to Colombia when I was in Dubai. I was seeing a therapist at the time, and I said to her, something's calling me to go to Dubai, to go to Colombia rather, go to Colombia. And I didn't know what it was at the time. And she said, well, if that's the case, then you have to go and check it out and do a recce, as we call it in the UK, and go and check it out and see if it's actually the place that you want to be, not just go willy-nilly and start from there. A month before Christmas, I booked a flight because I'd been seeing this therapist and she encouraged me to go and, you know, check it out. I paid through the nose for that ticket to go to Colombia from Dubai at Christmas and New Year. You can imagine.
I can just imagine the price.
And so I went to Colombia, probably the best time of the year, really. We're talking about Christmas and New Year. So I travelled around. I went to Cali, which is where they have the Salsa Festival at Christmas time, or in the Christmas moving to the New Year. I went to Bogota. I went to Cartagena. I went to Medellin. So those are the four main cities. And I came back feeling like, yeah, this is the place, especially when I went to Cartagena, which is on the Caribbean coast, which is a predominantly black city. That's the history of Cartagena. It's all about slavery. So you're in a city where they're serving fried fish, rice and peas, deep fried green bananas, and that kind of food that just, you know, reminded me of my upbringing. It's not particularly the same because they don't have the same spices as what are used in the other parts of the Caribbean. But the food resembled what I was used to and the people resembled me. And so when you're looking for a place to call home, those things are important to me. So that's how that happened. I left Dubai with qualifications. So I wasn't out there partying because the invitations didn't come my way, which was good. So I was able to do my yoga teacher training out there, 200-hour yoga teacher training course. And I was also able to do a swing yoga teacher training course whilst I was in Dubai. So I left Dubai with a little bit of money in my pocket from the savings and from, you know, the end of contract bonus, just a little bit, and qualifications. I also got my eyes lasered. I'd traveled a little bit in the region. So I left on a high note. I left on a high note is what I can say. I left having had a good experience and in a better position financially and with more qualifications. So there's little more you can say once you move on from a place that you leave in a greater situation than the way in which you came.
Now I'm going to take you back just a second because you said something about your brothers were excluded from the system. Like, can you explain a little bit more about that?
So we grew up in a very white neighborhood, a predominantly white neighborhood. We went to what was at one point in time a very white Catholic school in this very white neighborhood. And all of a sudden, a lot of black students from around the city, from miles away, started to attend this very once upon a time white Catholic school with a really good reputation. And it seemed as though, from where we were standing, that the school was on an agenda, had an agenda to get rid of all these black kids that started to attend the school. Because, you know, 2 years maybe before I was there, there were very, very few, even in my year, actually. So even in my year, there were very few black people, black students in the school. But even like the year above that, even less so. But then the year below, one of my brothers was in the year below me. The whole number of black students, and then it got, you know, there were even more black students. So the school was on an agenda to exclude as many of the black students as they could, and they did that in a very short period of time. We're talking about so my two brothers left that school with no qualifications. One was just kind of exited from the system and they just kind of dropped him off the cliff.
Wow. And is that possible?
The other one, yeah. And then the other one, at least, I think because I intervened, when I say intervened, I understood a little bit of what was going on. So I attended the meetings with my mother, because when you're a migrant and you're working and you're hustling, you're trying to keep your head above water and you don't understand the systems and you've never been through it before and they're trying to fuck with you and you don't have the skills, you don't have the knowledge, you don't have the support. That's where we find ourselves. But I went into the meetings with my mum when it came to my little brother. And I challenged whatever. I can't remember how it went exactly because we're talking about a long time ago. But he was then referred to what we call a pupil referral unit in the UK, which is where they send the naughty kids.
Okay.
And so he then had an opportunity to do some exams, but I don't think he did many, or they didn't go particularly well because he'd been out of the system for a little bit. And he wasn't, you know, he wasn't nurtured in school. It wasn't that experience for him, and it wasn't that experience for the older brother either. So my two younger brothers left school with no qualifications. I do have to say that one has gone on to improve his handwriting, to go on and improve his English skills. He's basically self-taught Arabic. He's a Muslim, and so he wanted to learn Arabic to be part of that world. And that's one of the most difficult languages to learn. So respect to him, because he now is out there having conversations in Arabic with people, and he's fluent. But you know, they were both just kicked out of the system and just kind of left to rot. And so that was where my initial desire to become a teacher came from. But the system is so racist, so unjust, so unfair, so underfunded, so many things. And parents are delusional. So when you made your comment about shaping the future, this isn't the job of parents. This isn't the job of teachers, rather, which is what they're trying to show now, that the teachers have to, you know, talk about, the teachers have to help boost the American economy. I mean, don't teachers have enough to deal with?
Exactly. You know, it's funny that, you know, you're talking about years ago, this racism was happening everywhere in the schools. And in America, they thought that this is it. It's just not happening everywhere in the world. But you're telling me, yeah, in the UK, the same thing happens. And I'm sure it happens in other countries where they have been trying to keep Black kids, Black students down. And it's just sad that here we are many years later and still the same thing is happening.
I mean, nothing is new. Nothing is new that we're experiencing today. Nothing is new. It's just another form of oppression. And the list goes on as to what it is. It has a different title, has a different look.
Yeah. It's insane. I mean, this is just the world we're living in now. And I hope something changes, but you know, sometimes I think like it's time for the dinosaurs to come back because we've totally screwed it up. You know, I don't know. So when you went to Colombia, how long did you stay?
So I went to Colombia with the intention of setting up a business. That was the reason that I went there, to start a life. In Colombia, they seem to be, from the outside, because I hadn't lived in Colombia or grown up there. Once upon a time, it had a terrible reputation of being, you know, the kidnapping yes. capital of the world, and the murder capital, and the drugs, and the, you know, all the rest of it, cartels. But I went there with a specific intention of setting up a business, and I changed the business in terms of what I wanted to set up, but that is what I did. And whilst I was there, it became like a bit of a comedy show, trying to do things, trying to make things happen.
Was there red tape like everywhere else, like in third world countries, you know, where you think you can't do things and it turns out that, you know, nothing you think is right. You got to pay off people and do all that stuff, or no?
No, it was that type of red tape, that type of situation. It wasn't red tape. So the system itself was pretty easy. Things have changed, I think, in recent years. But in Colombia, they were making it easy for foreigners to go into Colombia and set up a business. They offered like 15 different types of visas. Yeah. And they were making it really, really easy for foreigners to come in and help boost the economy and you know, start things and generate, you know, revenue and all the rest of it. They were making it really easy. Mm-hmm. So from that side, I was able to get my visa. I sponsored myself. I went through, I think I needed an accountant to verify that I had a certain amount of money. I sent that paperwork off. I registered the business at the Chamber of Commerce. I sent that paperwork off to the visa office in the capital in Bogota, and then I got my two year. They gave me a 1 year visa stay. So that wasn't that difficult. Registering the business wasn't that difficult, because registering a business then means you've got tax obligations, which I didn't realize all of this at the time. Yeah. And you have to declare your taxes at the end of the year. So it's generating money for the country. So of course you can set up a business anytime you want to.
What kind of business was it?
So the first one that I set up was the clothing store, an online clothing store.
Okay.
And then I registered, and I don't know why I did this the way that I did it. foolishness is what I would say, hastiness, which is part of who I am. I set up a cafe. I wanted to open up a cafe, but I registered the business before even doing the work, even before setting up anything. And I registered another business. I can't remember what that was. But yeah, so I registered three businesses for what reason? Because then I had tax obligations for each of those businesses and nothing to generate anything, and had to get an accountant. And then in the end, I tried to close them all down. And yeah, so hastiness and foolishness is what I would say. Yeah, so do your homework and make sure you know what you're doing and get proper guidance for anybody that's thinking about setting up a business in another country on your own.
Yeah.
Think about it and do it slowly as opposed to the way that I did it, because I just ended up paying for things and even paying for things that didn't generate anything. I hadn't even started them. I just registered the names. And in Colombia, it's like, you know, I was told by the Chamber of Commerce that some people register and then start, and some people start and then register afterwards.
Yeah.
And I want to be very British. Let me tell you that about being British. Let me do it the right way around.
You find out that it was just a money-losing proposition. Like
the right way around. How about who told us to do that? Now, foolishness.
Now, you're thinking of... You know, I know you're thinking of starting a business in Spain as well. Have you started that, or do you plan on starting that? Because you know how the autonomo, especially how the taxes are pretty high here.
Oh my God. So I just feel like I'm going to tell you this. So yes, this week I've been like chasing my tail, trying to speak to the assistants at the Chamber of Commerce and the business. What is it called? The Federation of business, that's what it's called. I think the Federation, yeah, I'm just trying to think of what it's called, but yeah, more than the red tape. I'm not too sure how it all works, but what I can say to you is I don't know if those people are really employed and they want to help you. Don't get me wrong, some of them do, but the support, they just go away and read all this information and research this information and go away and do this and go away and do that. That's how I feel, and then they're overwhelmed and overworked, and there's not enough people to do the job that needs to be done. For example, I have a consultant, you could say, at the Chamber of Commerce, who's been guiding me. Mm-hmm. I contacted her last week, or not this week, but last week, and she was like, I don't have any availability to see you. I've got doctor's appointments X, Y, and Z this day. Okay, that's fine. That's an appointment. So she said, let's try and do it by email. But I don't want to do things by email when we're talking about, one, we're working in another language, and two, there's so many requirements as to what has to be done. And then I contacted her to try and get an appointment for this week. She said, I've got the week's pretty tied up. It's really, really difficult. I don't have any availability this week. So then I popped into the office yesterday just to see if I could make an appointment with her for the following week. But she was doing consultations. I understand that. But then her colleague said to me, she's really busy because she's going on holiday next week.
I was just
going
to say, don't forget, August is like holiday time. So you can forget about that till September.
Yeah, and it's like, she won't be gone for long, just a couple of weeks. So I'm like, oh, really? So does anybody take over her work in her absence? No.
No, exactly. Because they'll all be gone as well.
Assistant, consultant to help you, the Chamber of Commerce. Yeah.
No, it's really weird because I know, like, we had been thinking, because Federico wanted to keep on doing his photography here, and you said to inquire about the fees you have to pay, and when you're an autonomo, they changed it so that the first 6 months you pay 50 euros a month to register yourself, and then after that it goes to like 100 euros a month, and then, you know, the top price is like 367 euros a month. But the thing that kills me is, like, you have to pay the money whether or not you make 1 euro. So basically, if he doesn't have any sessions booked after the first 6 months, he still has to pay 100 euros come the first of the month, because they don't care. And then after that, you can pay whatever, you know, you can earn whatever, but the first amount of money goes towards your autonomo registration, which is insane. And I think that's why there's a lot of black market, you know, like, I don't even know what they call it now, like where people work under the table, because it's just insane. And like you're saying, if you go into the company, the chain, the company, chamber of commerce that's supposed to help you, and they're just like, ah, I can't see you today. I can't. Everything is so like laissez-faire attitude.
I know. It's like, you understand why people do things under the table. You understand. And I was told by one of the consultants at the Chamber of Commerce, one of the initial people that I spoke to, she said, oh, what the laws are and what people to do are two different things. I've not left my head, because you can understand it.
Yeah.
So in Colombia, it was easy to set up the business. It was easy to do things, and the rules and the laws are relaxed. But here, I'm trying to understand all the rules and the regulations and the laws and the modified. I mean, the documents are like reading Russian.
Yes.
Regulations, so many things that you can't do. So many, you can understand why the fucking economy is so stagnant.
Yes. No, it's true. It's true, because really, you're so mired in red tape. I always tell people, like on the blog, I'm like, if you need to come here to work, you can just forget about it. If you come in here just to have a change of life and retire or whatnot, but if you need to work, oof, it's not easy unless you have a company, you know, like sponsoring you. Because trying to go through the red tape by yourself, it's insane. And I think that would so help the economy if they were just to say, okay, you know what? Instead of having it go above 50, just leave it at 50. And, you know, 50 euros a month for everybody, they would get so many hundreds of thousands of people registering their companies. I mean, actually doing it the legal way, they would get so much more revenue. But it's just, it's very strange. Like we can come here and look from the outside, but I guess they don't see it.
And we can't be the first people to be saying this. And it's a system that's, I don't know kind of how long things have been the way that they are, but it's just, you can understand why people do things illegally. The reason I say that in particular in regards to the Canary Islands, apparently the Canary Islands have always had a lower standard of living here, so people have always been paid less. The accommodation's really, really expensive here. The cost of living is when I talk about the cost of living, so rent and food, they are expensive because a lot of the products that are sold here are local produce. There's no rain here, so you're paying through the nose for everything. But the job market is so poor that people just about make enough to pay for the rent and maybe the bus pass and things like that. You know, the salaries here, you see salaries for like 800 euros, 1,000 euros. When rents here are like...
A month.
When rents here are like 500, 600, even 400 euros. You don't find anything here for 400 euros. Not an entire accommodation. You might find a room, but not an entire accommodation, and at the lowest of standards. But yeah, it's pretty, pretty terrible the way in which they expect people to live and thrive and for the economy to thrive, because it's such a bad circle when you've got, if people do things the legal way, so, you know, declaring their taxes, declaring their income, and then they're penalized for it and then they can't afford to pay their staff. You know, you can understand why people don't choose that route, but... Yeah, they don't make it easy for themselves.
I don't know. You know, it needs, something needs to change, especially now where with the coronavirus, the the tourism is just decimated. And so it's going to get much worse. And I don't know how they're going to get out of it apart from raising the taxes. So we'll just have to, they already announced they're raising the taxes, but let's see if it's going to get even higher and what else they're going to tax. So now, how long ago did you leave Colombia?
So I was in Colombia from 2016 to kind of midway 2018. Yeah.
Is that where you got your cats?
No. Yeah, of course, the cats are from Colombia, yeah.
That's why you're the Colombian cat woman, right?
Yeah. So I went to Colombia with great intentions, with a little bit of money, with a bit of my inheritance. I will say, not a bit, with my inheritance. It wasn't a huge amount, but I went there with my inheritance and with big dreams of, you know, starting businesses and adopting kids, because it would have been possible to adopt kids over there and finding the love of my life as a lesbian. Everything's legal there, but the reality is a very different situation. And I left Colombia with no money and four cats.
Oh, no. Oh, no. That's a hard lesson. A very expensive one, too.
Yeah. But sometimes we've got to have them, haven't we, to learn, to So, yeah.
So the dating scene wasn't, you know, as a queer woman of color, the dating scene wasn't very great?
Not on the Caribbean coast. So if you think about Caribbean culture, the church is very much ingrained in the way in which people think and behave and what's right and what's wrong. In big cities, that's a very different situation. But I didn't want to live in Bogota, in the capital, or Medellin, which is like the tourist, not the tourist, but the foreigner hotspot, because life is so easy and it's the city of eternal spring, etc. And I didn't want to live in Cali. And I don't know the exact reason for why, because I would have prospered more because things are more efficient in those cities. Mm-hmm. But living on the Caribbean coast was like I said before, a bit of a joke. Do so many things, the way in which things operated. And so dating people, you know, weren't openly out, and the gay communities quite persecuted, the Colombian gay communities persecuted on the Caribbean coast. And, you know, life, as much as being gay is legal, as much as adopting kids is legal, as much as getting married is legal in Colombia, on the Caribbean coast, people were quite, you know, covert about their lifestyles and mm-hmm. yeah, but that's what I can say. So dating for me, and I will say that Colombia isn't that special. I think the older you get, the more specific you are, or judgmental, whichever one of the two it is, you are about what you want, about what you're willing to expect. That I'm talking about not the we. So there are fewer opportunities to meet people, especially if you're working on your own, which is what I was doing. I was, you know, building a business and I wasn't socializing with people. And also I was dealing with my mental health. So I didn't want to socialize with people because it was a bit of a torturous experience for me. So I withdrew from society to a certain degree. And that also had an impact on, you know, meeting people. So all of those factors made dating pretty difficult. Doesn't mean that there weren't queer people. So in the village in which I lived in a village called Cienega Magdalena. So Cienega means the swamp or swampland. And in that village, there's an LGBT centre, which is the craziest of things. In this village, where, you know, in some parts of the village, in huge parts of the village, there's not even pavement. But
there was an LGBT. Okay.
I mean,
so they were progressive, but not that progressive.
Yeah, progressive, the free stuff, but the government funding to the government had sent the funding, and apparently they said to Bogota that everywhere's got pavement, is what they'd said, because what happens in places like Colombia is that the people who are high up take the money and do what they want with it. So yeah, LGBT centre, and at this LGBT centre, it was full of guys, and it was really great that they were attending and assisting. No, that's not English. They were in English. How do you say that? They were going to the centre. They were frequenting the centre and supporting the centre and working together. But the girls just never seemed to really use the centre. Trans women, yes, but cis women, no. And so it was a weird experience. I was glad to have that, you know, gay centre there in this little village, but it wasn't an opportunity for me to meet many, many women, is what I would say, many cis women. So that was the village there. And it doesn't mean that gay people aren't in Colombia. And I was surprised at the number of gay people, and this particular in this village that I lived in, it's like every fucking young guy is gay. Am I living in the backwater swamp? And there were just like so many, and I, like, you know, became friends, and we were like, we would frequent places and you know, hang out. And I'm like this, what am I, 45 now, woman? So I was only, you know, a few years ago hanging out with all these 18, 16 year old kids, going to the river and doing stuff with them. Yeah.
That's incredible that a small village like that would be so hip. That's great, though.
We really, really, like, I've never experienced anything like that. And so is this what the whole of Colombia is like? I don't know. But I know that the big cities are really progressive, and they've got the gay communities and the gay pride ceremonies and you know, are big in the big cities. But, yeah, this little backwater village had this kind of thriving gay community, which was weird. But great.
So because that, you know, the big city life didn't appeal to you, you decided to leave Colombia altogether?
No, it wasn't about the big... So, yes, the big city life didn't appeal to me. I'm a child of Caribbean parents. I want to be where the skies are blue and where the weather's warm. Cartagena is a really hot, sticky city. Yeah. Very uncomfortable, the heat in Cartagena. But I wanted to be near the coast and I wanted to be near mountains. And not to say that Colombia is a very diverse landscape, but one of the most diverse and biodiverse places on the earth. But I didn't want the city life. City life isn't good unless you're making lots of money. City life is hard. And also as a black person, city life, I think, is yes, you've got more opportunities, but no. I'm from a big city. I'm from the second city. I'm from Birmingham. And cities are great, but all you're kind of doing is spending time traveling and spending money outside. There's something about kind of simple living, which I think we all need to get back to. And that's also where I'm at this moment in time. With the cost of living so high, with the cost of food so high, we need to go back to simple living. So when I lived in Cartagena, you'd be walking down the streets and, you know, the mangoes are on the floor in abundance. And here in Gran Canaria, as an island, as a city, Las Palmas, here where mangoes are grown, but mangoes, they're selling mangoes at like 14 euros a kilo. The price is
going
a bit now because, as I was saying before, that water, there's a shortage of water and da 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 da. So it's now at like 5 euros a kilo, the cheapest place that you'll find. But I mean, 14 fucking, that's more than gold.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I love mangoes, but not that much, right?
Exactly. So I've had like two since I've been here. Or three. I bought two.
It's like, I have a little piece now and I'll save this one for later.
But then the other day I went up into the valley and I was at like somewhere and there was an abundance of mangoes on the floor and it took me back to Colombia. You know, that's how we should be living, really. And that's what I want, because the city life will really kill us. And as black people, the city life will kill us because we're always kind of at a disadvantage with so many things, living, support networks, jobs, you know, mental health. No. We have to protect ourselves because there are so many things that just kind of are detrimental to our health.
Yes. How are you finding life there?
Lonely. Is one adjective that just comes to mind, and it's the most difficult place in which I've worked to kind of not worked. I'm not working, and I haven't worked a lot here as well. Corona, the job situation didn't work out, and yeah, so lonely is what really, really just kind of hits me hard. People are quite good on the whole. People are quite helpful on the whole. But integrating Corona doesn't help in terms of the last like 5 months. But even prior to that, it's been, and I've been saying this to myself a lot this week, that the place that I've spent the most amount of time on my own, and everything is for a reason, but it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Now, do you think it's harder because you're black, or is it because you're gay, or, you know, why do you think it's so hard?
So I would definitely say black is part of it. Would I say a big part of it? Do people mix here? There's not a lot of mixing going on in terms of older people, but the young people, maybe, yes. But I would say that's a huge part of it. I would also say you meet people where you work, and I'm not working. And I haven't worked in the last, like, you know, so many months due to COVID. The culture's quite closed in terms of Canarians. It's not like anybody saying, you need to come to my house and try my grandma's recipe.
No, they don't do that. No matter, we've lived in three cities now, and they just, that's not Spanish culture, really, that I've found anyway. And from talking to my friends, it's not, you know, they have their own friends and they stick with their family, and that's pretty much it.
That's it.
And, you know, if you work with them, then you can go out for a drink. But a friend of mine, you know, in Valencia, I mean, when we lived in Sevilla, told me that it's because so many generations live together to save money or whatnot. So they don't really have any privacy or space in their house because there's so many people. And that's why a lot of people go out and they meet their friends out, because, you know, they never bring them home, because it's not shame. It's just that there's no privacy. There's no space.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting.
That kind of makes sense. But I would say that it feels as though there's no need for outsiders. One, I would also say, because I'm living on an island that's a tourist island, that's the biggest economy in the Canaries. So people are transient. They come and they go, and they come and they go. And so I would imagine that people aren't looking to make friendships with people if they don't know that they're going to be around for the next year and invest in people. So there are a number of factors. Black, I'm not working, so I'm not socializing. The transient community, the issues that you just said about the way in which Spanish culture is. And so in Colombia, it was like, you need to try my grandmother's recipe, or you haven't tried anything until you tried my culture. I can't really stand it, but you know, all that pride and all the rest of it, and that openness and that kind of curiosity of the other. I don't feel that there's that curiosity here. It's you know, somebody might make a comment and say, I like your style, but that's kind of it. And guys might look to think that they want to fuck you, or they like what they see, but that's, you know, not what I'm here for, not what I'm interested in. And that's about as much as I've had. I mean, it's very close. I order my pet food online because I buy it in bulk. And the one day a delivery was attempted to my property, I wasn't here, I was at work. So we suggested that they try the next door neighbour to see if they received the parcel. My next door neighbours refused the parcel. They refused to accept the parcel. We're talking about cat food.
Wow.
So there's only one family on the road that I really speak to, and that's the Colombian family in front of my property.
Yeah.
And I said, ask the Colombians in front, and the Colombians, yes, the Colombians, because their culture is very servile.
So
no problem. Whenever the parcel's here, we'll receive. And, you know, that's the kind of attitude. And like, we're talking about cat food, we're not talking about the receival of my iPhone or, you know,
Or your drugs from Colombia.
You might go and sell it off to somebody else really quickly. We were talking cat food, and it's like, when you know that the neighbours won't fucking accept a delivery of cat food, a box of cat food, then you know you've got a problem.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, that happens in the US too, so... So it doesn't shock me at all, really.
It just shocked me. I don't have been anywhere and had that experience. Sorry. Yeah.
What do you plan on doing? Do you think you're going to stick around there, or are you going to try someplace else? Would you ever go back to the UK?
So the UK, it hasn't been my home for the last 20 years, not on a permanent basis. And I've tried, and I don't see myself living in the UK in the short term, especially UK politics, UK government. Boris Johnson as a prime minister is appalling. He's the devil incarnation, just like your guy, your man. And then the UK's preparing to leave the European Union. This is not the time to go back to the UK in any way, shape or form for me. I'm exhausted of travelling. I'm exhausted of starting again. I'm exhausted of selling my goods or giving my goods away for nothing. And I was talking about this week to somebody else. Let me tell you, when I was in Colombia and I created a clothing line in honour of my late mother, it was called La Gran Angela. La Gran Angela. And when the clothes didn't sell because the way that Colombia is and the way that I am, I had to walk away and leave a whole load of those clothes on the floor that I had designed and sent and made and purchased the material and the goods and all the rest of it and all the time and money and effort that went into that. And so it wasn't the only thing I sent. I sold a virtually brand new washing machine for next to nothing, because who are you going to sell it to? Who's going to buy it? When you live in a poor place, who's going to buy it, you know, for the price that it's worth?
Yeah.
So I've done it many, 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 many times over. And I'm tired of giving away my goods and having no value and having to start again and having to buy even a fork again. I'm tired. Yeah. I've done it for the last 20 years in many, many countries, continents. And also, being the Colombian cat woman, I'm now choosing, because people just say, give them away, give them away, give them away, to travel with four cats. So it makes everything so much more difficult. At one stage, when I was in the UK, I was looking at getting a teaching job in the Far East in China, because that's where the packages are good. Now they're the kind of equivalent packages that used to be available in the Middle East like 10 years ago. So the packages are really, really good, great opportunities to save. But when I started to look into traveling with four cats to China, one of the quotes came back at $7,000. And, you know, China's not on the top of my list anyway, but then... And then on top of that, as countries, I was looking at researching where could I go to go and make some money to go and save again, you know, do what I need to do to get back on my feet again. So China is one of those countries that, like the one child rule that they had for years, they also have one pet rule, which I didn't know about. So when I started to research that, you can only travel directly to China with one cat, or you can go via Hong Kong. Now the Hong Kong situation's changing, but via Hong Kong, using a company to get the, and just like, hell no. And when I look at other countries, the Middle East, it's like 6 months to do the paperwork to travel with the pets. And there's like the procedure's ridiculous. And people keep on saying, just get rid of them, get rid of them, get rid of them. But if I get rid of them today, what will I have?
Yes. And their family also, you know, like they tell us that when we have trouble finding rentals with our two dogs, we did in Malta a lot of trouble. And when we first got to Spain too, and it's not easy, you know, they're your family. So you have to put up with a lot of crap. And my husband is like, we put up with a lot of shit, you know, but you have to, because they've become family at that point.
They are.
Now, looking back, maybe I would have said, you know, we should have tried harder to like home them before we left. But I know that I would probably do the same thing all over again if I had to. I just couldn't think about leaving them. We just had to bring them with us. So I understand.
Yeah, it's like, why leave them? Because today you leave them because you can't get a place, and then tomorrow you find somewhere else. And for me, they're the one thing that I have to get up for. I don't have a family. I don't have a partner. I don't have any friends. It's them. They wake me up. They, my little auntie.
You're saving your sanity right now.
I don't have anything else. When I say I don't have anything else, I don't have any other living being in my life. Living beings in my life that I, you know, and I'm responsible for them, and we're attached to each other, and I've thought about it, and you know, at times I was close to giving two of them up, because it's so expensive traveling with cats, traveling with pets, and the everything, and it's so difficult finding places to live and all the rest of it, which I'm sure you know. And so I was at one point when I was in the UK to give away two of them that would have been okay together, and they would have gone to a cat cafe in Birmingham or in the West Midlands in Shakespeare Land, and I said no at the last minute, and I'm glad I did. And it's hard, and sometimes one is annoying or whatever, and all the rest of it. But I'm glad that I've fought to keep them together, because right now, where do I go? Back to your question, what am I going to do? I'm going to stay right here. As fucking difficult as it's been, as hard as it's been, I've been sacked twice on this island. One, because I couldn't do the job. And the other place, because of COVID. And then I've had the hardest time, the loneliest of times, but I'm staying right here. I'm staying put. And here is where I'm going to build from. Because of everything that I've just said to you, I'm tired. I'm not giving them away. I'm tired of giving away my goods and things. I don't have a lot. I don't have a lot, but whatever I've got, I don't want to give it away today and then have to look for it tomorrow. That's what we do, isn't it? So, no.
Wow. Now, that takes a lot of courage, you know, because a lot of people would have just given up and found another place to go to and just keep going, and they wouldn't be, but you're standing your ground and you're saying, and I think, you know, with Spanish culture, with them being closed, after a while, like a couple of years, I mean, it takes a really, really long time. I was telling my friend the other day, you know, there used to be this lady, one of the apartments that we had first lived in when we came here. I would walk my dog every day, and I saw her in the lobby every single day. And because being American, I just say hello to everybody, and I have a really bad memory remembering people, so the same, you know, I forget it's her the next morning I say hello. So for like a year this went on, and she just would look at me and just go right by me, not even say hello back, nothing. And we finally got another apartment to move to, a smaller one, because this one was just ginormous for us. And maybe about 3 days before we left, we didn't tell anybody we were leaving. We didn't pack. We didn't do anything like that. She would see me. Oh, hello. Like, I think they think that everybody that comes there is just going to be there temporarily. They didn't want to spare the energy to even try and get to know you. So after a year of constantly seeing me, she finally said hello. And I was just like, hello, but goodbye, you know? She only said hello back 2 days and then we moved. And it's just like, that's just the way it is. They think everybody here to, you know, it's only now we've been in this apartment for a year. And it's only now that, you know, the same people that we see, they say hello to me when they walk with their dogs. Now they know that they're not here just to, you know, work for 6 months or whatever. But we're like, no, we're here and this is it. We're gonna die in this apartment probably. So I think it's good that you're staking your ground, and you know, I think eventually they'll start opening up when they see that you're here to stay.
Well, there are different things. One is because I've chosen to keep the cats. And because that makes my life even more difficult, my next goal, even though I'm unemployed, even I'm on unemployment benefit, my next goal is to get my own home, to buy my own home, so that I'm in control of my destiny, so that nobody can reject me, reject us. So it's using the negative, as we say in Buddhism, the turning the poison into medicine. So using the negative situation that nobody wants to rent to me because I've got four cats. Like, cats do anything other than sleep and eat and fucking shit. But using that to guide and to push and to make sure that I get some stability in my life, that I create stability, that I find a home for us, and that home will be our home, my home. I will own it. Not outright, but in some way, shape or form. But that's the goal, that's the driving force. And the reasons also are that, the reason that I've talked about, but also I don't know if there's anywhere else to go. I've visited lots of countries. I've lived in different countries and different continents. Where do I go to next?
Yeah.
That's how I feel now. Where do I go to next?
I know one of the places you were in was South Africa, is that right?
No, I've not been to South Africa.
Okay.
And again, as a lesbian, I'm like, I think South Africa's, I've heard really good things about South Africa. Really gay, really buzzing gay community, really progressive city, this, that, the other. But I don't, as a black person, I feel like South Africa, how can it be a great place?
Yeah. I mean, we've been to Johannesburg and we really liked it. And I'm like, oh, I could totally live here. But, you know, for a whole different, lots of reasons, I'm like, no, you know. But it was definitely, definitely nice. And everybody talks about Cape Town being like the place to be. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I have a friend here in Valencia who's like, I don't want to go back. I am just, you know, she's white. She's like, I just don't want to go back. I have to find some old gizzard, as she calls it, to get married to or something. And anything, just don't make me go back. So it's very strange. But, you know, everybody goes somewhere and has different experiences. And I think when people tell you that, you have to figure out, are they talking from a tourist experience, which is very different than when you actually go there to settle and, you know, try and make a life for yourself.
Definitely, definitely. Where do you guys think, why have you guys chosen Spain?
Oh, here, we're in Valencia. This is it. This is it for us. We're not going anywhere else. And we actually did the same thing. You know, we recently bought the apartment here, and you know, this is it. We're putting our stakes in the ground and we're going to stay here. We love it.
Okay.
But you know, life is not easy anywhere, especially, you know, I'm sure being on that island where it's sort of like, yeah, it's Spain, but it's like, it's kind of cut off and you're just, I mean, I admire the fact that you have the fortitude to stay and the strength, really, because like I said, a lot of people would have just said, hey, I'm going to go somewhere else. But like you said, you've traveled around. Now, what are the other places that you might have even considered apart from Colombia? Like what other places might you have considered going to?
Thailand. I went to Thailand some years ago and I just loved the city of Bangkok. I don't think I'd want to live in Bangkok with pets, but I just had a really good experience in Thailand. I love nature, and green is an important colour to me. So I need to be where there's greenery, there's nature, there's foliage. And there are parts of the Caribbean which are beautiful, but it all comes down to, I have to think about being a black woman, I have to think about being a lesbian, I have to think about having pets. So when you think, do I go to China? Where am I going to end up in China? In some apartment in 100, 100-story building with four cats? Do I go to backpack? It's going to be the same kind of thing. Do I go to the Caribbean? Then I have to live a kind of lifestyle that, you know, maybe I can't talk freely. Maybe I can't live freely. Maybe it'd be fine. Maybe not. Do I go to Germany, which has got a really buoyant economy and it's really progressive, and Berlin is a really good city? But then as a black lesbian, do I want to go? And then it's cold. And then I just feel like I've traveled, and if I want to continue traveling, I can do that. But I just need to put stakes. Like you said, I need to put stakes down. I need to find a home. I need somewhere to call it. I need to be in control of my destiny more. And I don't want people telling me that I'm not welcome because I've got four cats, or I'm not welcome because I'm black, or whatever. And so it's about being here. And now it's about building something that creates some type of community, because this is also what I feel. I feel as though, I'm going to say we, but I'm always searching for community. I'm always searching for community, and it's really, really important to me. And I don't have it here. But rather than searching for it, stay put and create it.
I found like what helped me, you know, because I'm kind of shy meeting people. And a friend of mine who had moved here from Ecuador, we started a Facebook foodie group. So basically once a month we meet and we'll go out, try different restaurants in Valencia. But it was a way of like putting myself out there and actually forcing myself to meet people who had moved here and were staying here. And, you know, so far it's grown to like more than 400 people of people wanting to be here, people who are already here, people who are thinking of going here. So like when they come like on their mission, like a research mission, they come to the lunches, they decide, you know, they meet other people. So I think that's something you might want to consider. Maybe, you know, like you said, make it happen yourself. On that island, there may be also people who are trying to reach out, but don't know how.
Yeah,
just start small.
Happening here, but I'm just not interested in some of them. That's the truth. And so, but I need to put myself out there. One, because I don't want to continue living like this. Two, because I want to start dating again. I haven't dated in years. And so, you know, it makes for a very, very lonely life. And I don't want that for myself. I'm happy with my own company. I'm happy. I'm a thinker. I'm a, you know, I'm intelligent enough to kind of, you know, develop myself and learn different things and all the rest of it. But I don't want to just live a life on my own all the time. It's too much. And we're not built to live like that either as human beings.
Yeah.
Pets are great, but they're not humans.
Thank you so much for being candid about this, because a lot of people think, you know, when you travel, everything is so rosy and life is this, because they see, you know, the stories and it's all like wonderful and, you know, but you're giving people a dose of reality. It's a lonely life if you're not, you know, around people. You can be an introvert, you can be this, but you can be that. But we, like you said, we need company, we need contact. So it's nice that you're being honest with people and not just, you know, I don't know what the, you know, like blowing smoke up people's butts. So thank you for that.
I think it's also though, but just remember, I'm talking from the perspective of a black woman, and our experiences are always different when we travel to our white counterparts. And so I grew up seeing white counterparts traveling and having the time of their life and going around the world and meeting all of these people and having these really expat nomadic experiences. But as a black woman, the welcome mat wasn't necessarily there everywhere that I've been. Let's just say that much. And then as a lesbian, the welcome mat isn't there everywhere. So if I go to the black place,
tinier.
and that's it. And then the older you get, the fewer the opportunities, and the older you get, the more reserved you are about what you want. So what you did when you were 20 and what you accepted when you were 20, like those false kind of friendships that you know, you meet those people and you think you're going to be best friends, or your best friends for the time being, and then you never see them again, or your best friends for 6 months. When you're 40 and 45, I don't want those kind of friendships. I want depth. I want reality. Yeah. I want the real deal. So, you know, we're looking for depth now, and there's no point in anything else, in my opinion. So yes, I'd rather be by myself than have the bullshit, than have fakeness, yeah. than have, you know, people that I can't trust around me, that have people that don't tell the truth, or people, you know, all of those things. I'm not interested in them. I'm not interested in any false smiles. Life's too short for that kind of stuff. Too old. Seen it all. Yeah.
It's true. No, I've found myself, I've changed a lot then, you know, since when I was young. And there's so many things that I am not willing to accept now that might have been okay before. Yeah. I'm more open with what I want. I speak more freely. So I think it comes with age. Mm-hmm. And it's great that you're doing what you're doing, and you know what you want, and you know what you need, and you're not willing to accept any less.
Why shouldn't? Why shouldn't?
No, you shouldn't. Now, Jeanette, thank you for being on this show. It's been wonderful, but I'll leave you with one last question. What would be your advice for somebody, like, you know, another young woman listening to this saying, you know what, I think I want to try the nomadic life. I am not happy with what I'm doing. I want to experience life. Is there some sort of advice you would give them?
I would say live your dreams. I would say don't listen to the naysayers, because there are plenty of them. I would say align yourself with like-minded people. I would say, like you, I've traveled to lots of countries. I've been to Nepal. As a black girl from Birmingham, I never would have even dreamt of going to Nepal. I've been to Vietnam. I've been to Thailand. I've worked in Jamaica. I've worked in Dubai. I've worked in Spain. Travel. See the world. Learn things. Learn how everything's interconnected. Learn about the history of people. Embed yourself in the culture as much as you possibly can. Don't just be a tourist, superficially existing in a country, having a great time, but when the local people are living and sleeping on the streets. Integrate yeah. into the community, get to know people, travel, make friends, but make true friends, make real friends, and don't settle for anything less. Full stop.
Oh, that's awesome advice. Thank you so much for being on the show, Jeanette. Thanks. Now, for everybody listening, Jeanette also has a podcast by the name of The Colombian Catwoman. So you can find that on iTunes.
Anchor and all of the podcast platforms. Primarily it's on Anchor, it's on Spotify, it's on iTunes, it's available on I think about 8 platforms. So The Colombian Catwoman.
Great. And I'm going to leave the information also on the Next Bite of Life podcast page and the blog that goes with it. You can get information on how to get in touch with Jeanette if you want to. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening to this episode, and we'll see you on the next one.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeanette. Bye.
Bye-bye.